You'll hear a number of different recordings and you will have to answer questions based on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions, and you will have a chance to check your work. All the recordings will be played once only. The test is in four sections. At the end of the test, you will be given 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the answer sheet. Now turn to section one.
Section one. You will hear part of a telephone conversation between a job seeker and a recruitment agent. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 6. You will see that there is an example that has been done for you. On this occasion only, the conversation relating to this will be played first.
Yes, so that's Janet Thompson. Would you like me to spell it?
If you wouldn't mind, thank you. Just a surname, please.
No problem. It's T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N.
The job seeker's surname is Thompson. So you write Thompson in the space provided. You should answer the questions as you listen because you will not hear the recording a second time. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 6.
Yes, so that's Janet Thompson. Would you like me to spell it?
If you wouldn't mind, thank you. Just the surname, please.
No problem. It's T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N.
Great. Now, Janet, before we go through the openings I have here in front of me, might I just take a few more details to complete your profile on my system?
Of course. What would you like to know?
Well, let's start with your email address, please.
Okay, janthompson@hort.net.
I see. Is that Jan as in J-A-N?
No, that wasn't available. I had to make do with J-A-N-N. Here, let me spell it for you again, just to be sure. janthompson@hort.net.
Much obliged. And could I ask, do you have your referee details to hand?
Yes, what do you need?
I need one work reference and one character reference from a friend or colleague.
OK, for a work reference, there's Jane Foote. She's my former boss at Bermuda Girls School, head of English.
OK.
My personal referee is Monica Carbody. Mon and I have been best friends since we met in Bermuda in 1991, when she was deputy head of English under Mrs. Foote.
Perfect. And you mentioned, of course, that you're an English teacher, but are there any additional subjects you're qualified to teach?
Yes, I have a diploma in special needs, and I can also do history to GCSE level.
Very good.
Before listening to the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 7 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 7 to 10.
Do you think I stand a good chance of finding something?
Oh, better than good. In fact, we have some positions we can offer you today. You see, it's not so difficult to find a temporary role. Tell you the truth, there are plenty of them around, but getting a permanent position will prove a little more trying, though. Would you be prepared to take up a position short term?
Of course, anything that pays.
Excellent. Well, there are 3 positions that I can offer you right now. The first is a teacher of English in LaSalle School. I'm sure you know it, right in the city centre.
Yes, near where I live, actually.
Even better. Well, it's a 6-month contract, and the very attractive thing about this role is that the head of English at LaSalle will, if she's satisfied with your performance after 6 months, offer to make you a permanent member of staff.
Wow, that's food for thought.
It certainly is, bearing in mind what I said before about how hard it is to find a permanent role. The second position I have to offer you is in a school near Chelsea. It's called the Chelsea Free School. Are you familiar?
I can't say that I've heard of it.
Well, this contract is for 1 year, which is a lot better, looking at it from a short-term job security perspective, than the first role I mentioned. But you also have to realise that you are a temporary replacement for a female teacher who has taken maternity leave. There is no prospect of the position being made permanent.
I see.
I have one other vacancy at the minute, though I doubt you'll find it quite so appealing. It's situated in rural Cambridgeshire. I'll spell that just in case you want to take it down. CAMBRIDGESHIRE. And the school simply goes by the name Cambridge, though it's not in any way related to the other more well-known establishment of the same name.
I was just going to ask that. What a lovely location, though, eh?
Yes, but there's a catch. It's only a 6-week contract to cover for someone on extended sick leave.
I see. Well, I guess that's ruled out then. What sort of salary can I...
That's the end of section one. You have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section two. Section two. You will hear a flight attendant talking to passengers on an airplane. First, you will have time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 15.
Good morning, everyone. I hope you all slept soundly overnight. I'm pleased to confirm that our flight is running on schedule and we expect to arrive in Christchurch at 8 a.m. local time. That's about 50 minutes from now. I've been advised by our pilot to warn you that there may be some turbulence on our descent. So please remain seated and have your seatbelt on at all times. As you may have heard, a fairly severe tropical depression is headed for New Zealand and, in fact, is reaching the west coast of the South Island as we speak. Thankfully, we are landing on the east coast, where the weather is still relatively good. Wind speeds are steady at around 15 miles per hour and the sky is generally overcast, though the sun may creep out from time to time as the morning progresses. That said, when the storm reaches us afternoon, conditions will deteriorate rather quickly. Please exercise extreme caution if you're travelling anywhere on the island today. As I said, the storm has already made landfall on the west-northwest coast, and we're getting reports of high seas and very strong winds of around 75 miles per hour, with gusts up to 110 in Collingwood. Heavy and thundery rainfall is also being reported there. The Southern Alps are experiencing severe blizzard conditions, and there is a virtual whiteout on the roads. There are accumulations of up to 3 foot of snow already, so please, under no circumstances, be tempted to take the mountain road from Christchurch to Bluff. Use the coastal route for the entire journey if you must go down south. Over in the west, in Hokitika, and the southwest, in Milford, conditions are bad with heavy rain, high winds, and high seas. In fact, several tornadoes were reported in Hokitika and also in Lewis, which is slightly further inland. Also inland, on the northern edge of the Southern Alps, Arthur's Pass should be avoided at all costs. Roads are closed due to the heavy snowfall. Kaikoura has reported wind speeds of 45 miles per hour, with occasional gusts a bit stronger, but so far it has escaped the heavy rain. At present, it is windy and cloudy there.
Before you hear the rest of the discussion, you have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen and answer question 16 to 20.
Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. We should be landing in approximately 10 minutes' time. Just an update for you on the weather conditions in and around Christchurch. We expect the storm to reach us by approximately 1 p.m. Town officials are closing all roads out of town as conditions are simply going to be too dangerous, with the risk of falling trees and flying debris too high. Roads will have officially been closed for 30 minutes by the time we land at 8 a.m. Passengers whose travel plans did not entail an overnight stay in Christchurch, we would like to extend our apologies to you on behalf of the Christchurch Town Council for the inconvenience caused. However, it is in the interest of safety that these steps have been taken. Those of you without accommodation should go straight to our customer service desk at the airport, where a council official will be waiting to take you to temporary shelters in the town. Those of you who are staying in Christchurch should go to your hotel and follow the instructions of staff there. It may yet be necessary to evacuate you down to the shelters as well. This decision will be made by hotel staff, who are monitoring the situation very carefully. The storm has made a direct hit on the island. The storm eye is expected to arrive in Christchurch at about 4 p.m., after which a brief period of calm will be experienced. The western wall of the storm will then hit at approximately 4:30, and the extreme winds and heavy rain should have improved by about 7 p.m. All roads will be reopened from 9 p.m. onwards. However, we're advising people to refrain from driving unless absolutely necessary, as conditions will be extremely hazardous with a risk of flooding everywhere. Flash flooding is a real danger for the valley towns of the south in particular, as mountain rivers and tributaries have already swelled to record levels. High winds have already caused massive power cuts in West Coast towns, and a string of major tornadoes have caused havoc across the Midlands. If at all possible, stay in Christchurch until tomorrow morning, when the clean-up will begin. And, above all, stay safe.
That's the end of section two. You have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section three. Section three. You will hear a discussion between two psychology students and their tutor. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 24. So, how did you find the lecture yesterday?
Reasonably interesting, but he sort of rushed through Maslow's work, which, considering it's been covered before, is fine for everyone else except me, who missed the last lesson.
Why don't you fill him in then, Tina?
Me? Oh, OK. Well, basically, it's simple enough. We all have certain needs, and what Maslow did was group them into categories. Depending on how successful your life has been or what stage of life you are at, your needs change and you shift from one of Maslow's categories into another. First, there's your basic needs.
Physiological needs, the professor said. Is that right?
Very good.
These needs are pretty obvious. They're our most basic ones. Things every human needs to survive and function, like air, water, food, clothing and shelter. It's not rocket science, this bit. Maslow just points out that until we have satisfied those basic needs, our desires don't evolve into anything more complex and we don't seek any greater form of fulfillment.
Isn't that a bit irrelevant today?
Not really. Millions of people in the developing world are still fighting to fulfill these needs, fighting for their very lives every day.
Good point.
So anyway, Maslow represented what he called his hierarchy of needs on a pyramid, or in 2D, a triangle.
With physiological being at the base, presumably.
Yes, it's obvious, isn't it?
What's at the other end of the spectrum, then?
Well, to be at the pinnacle, you've got to have mastered the other levels of need. Then you are in the self-actualization zone. This is a place where you are very at one with yourself and looking to make the absolute most of your skills, talent and potential. You can only focus on maximising these, though, of course, if, as Maslow reminds us, you're fulfilled in every other sense.
And what are these in-between levels, then?
Well, after you've found food and water and shelter and so on, the next step is to fulfil your safety requirements.
Safety does not just mean your physical safety, though. That's far too simplistic. It's also about your emotional safety, your job security and so on.
And let me guess, after that it's the need for esteem.
No, Maslow reasoned that after your physiological and safety needs are fulfilled, the next most urgent requirement is for friendship, intimacy, companionship and so on. You know, on an emotional level, building a family, having relationships, etc. Only then, after you have found a sense of belonging, does the need for esteem take precedence, he argues.
Presumably that's the need to feel accepted and valued.
Yes, but more on that later. Do you feel more comfortable now?
Yes. Thank you both.
Before you hear the rest of the discussion, you have some time to look at questions 25 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 25 to 30. Okay, now that you are both familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, let's look at a few cases in point. Case one, crime boss in the slums of Mumbai. What do you think?
Surely very low. Physiological, I'd have said.
But he has food and shelter.
A shed is hardly shelter. And how is living from hand to mouth every day adequate from a nutritional perspective?
Oh, of course. You're right if you look at it objectively. But remember that human psychology is far more complicated than that. When quizzed, this person surprised researchers. First of all, he regarded his shed as adequate shelter and was completely content there. Secondly, he generally felt satisfied with his level of food intake. Thirdly, being the crime boss of the slums, he felt very safe, arguing that no one would ever touch him. He had no self-esteem issues either, since he had the respect of his fellow slum dwellers. It may have been fear, but he perceived it as respect. That is all that matters, and was quite content with who he was.
I see. So it's not just about the reality of your situation, but also how you perceive that reality.
Exactly. Most people would be very low on the hierarchy in his position, feeling like they wanted and needed much more. He did not. Now, what about case two? A multi-millionaire rock star.
Well, you'd naturally assume he's fulfilled his physiological and safety needs, but when you read on through his profile, look here, he's plagued by paranoia and thinks someone is trying to kill him. On that basis, given his state of mind, he must believe that his safety is compromised. So safety must be his primary concern.
Very good.
And look here at case three, a property magnate. Having suffered badly during the recession, his portfolio of properties is in danger of being repossessed. In fact, look, he's in danger of losing everything and being left without even enough to support himself. Wow, so I guess he's gone from very high up right down to the bottom.
Exactly. Even his basic needs are no longer secure. An excellent example of how there can be movement both ways on the pyramid.
Case four, a housewife. She must have some esteem issues, surely.
Read on. she is quite content and well-respected and loved by her friends and family. What's more, being a housewife is all she ever wanted to do, and she has excelled at the task. Therefore, forget esteem. This lady has maximised her potential in her eyes. She's right at the top.
And case five?
A very sad case. It is what it is. There are always innocent victims of war, and he was left with nothing, not even a home over his head. Every day is a struggle to survive. How sad.
And last but not least, case six. Another rock star, though a different story. He says the only thing he craves is friendship. He has everything, but is awfully lonely. I think it's obvious where he is on Maslow's hierarchy.
Indeed.
That's the end of section three.
Now turn to section four. Section four. You will hear part of a talk about what happened at the Fukushima power plant after the March 2011 earthquake. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 36. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 36. To really understand what went on at Fukushima after the tragedy, which was the March the 11th tsunami, I'm going to have to give you a brief introduction to nuclear power and an insight into how a nuclear power plant like Fukushima functions. Look at the diagram here on the screen. To the left, there is a rather massive building. This is known as the containment building, and it is, safety-wise, the most fundamental aspect of a nuclear power plant. Containment buildings are typically constructed of steel or reinforced concrete. The Fukushima one was made of a mixture of both. Notice the concrete domed roof, which was so prominent in the aerial photographs which were taken after the tsunami hit. The containment building is, of course, always completely airtight, to prevent leakage of radioactive material in the event of a malfunction or failure of plant systems. It should also be natural disaster proof, and Fukushima's was, given the regularity with which they occur in Japan, able to withstand huge magnitude earthquakes. It also withstood the giant tsunami which struck. The containment building itself, therefore, did its job. But more on this later. The containment building houses the reactor core, which is where all the nuclear reactions take place. You will also notice the four cooling rods. These rods can be raised and lowered as required to control reaction speed and soak up neutrons. Now, if you look to the right-hand side of the containment building, you'll notice the coolant system, which basically regulates the temperature of the core and prevents it from overheating. You have hot water from the coolant system flowing into the heat exchanger and cold water flowing back into the containment building. This hot water is then transferred through the feed pumps into the turbine hall, where it is harnessed to drive the turbines and generate electricity. But before the energy can be distributed into the national grid, it must be sent through a new conductor. And this is the function of the missing piece of the puzzle, the transformer. The transformer allows electricity to be conducted from the turbines into the national grid. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how nuclear-powered electricity is generated, more or less. Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 37 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 37 to 40. So, what went wrong at Fukushima? Well, let's begin at the beginning. When the earthquake struck, the reactors automatically shut down. Of course, there were six reactors at Fukushima, so think of it as six plants, like the one in the diagram, running independently of one another. In actual fact, only three of the reactors needed to be shut down, as reactors 4 to 6 were being inspected, so had already ceased to be operational. When the reactors shut down, no more electricity was being produced. So a new source of power was needed to run the cooling systems and prevent the reactor core from overheating. This is where the plant's on-site diesel generators came in. They were immediately powered on and the reactor core's temperatures were being regulated again. So far, so good. But 50 minutes after the earthquake, the tsunami hit, breaching the plant's 5.7-metre defensive seawall. The tsunami flooded the basements of the six turbine halls and disabled the diesel generators. And this is where the problem began. You see, the containment buildings actually did their job, and reactors 1 to 6 were not compromised by the earthquake or the subsequent tsunami. However, site engineers and safety personnel had failed to take into account the possibility of the seawall being compromised. Once this happened and the turbine halls flooded, the diesel generators were useless. It was going to be a race to get the coolant systems up and running again in time to stop meltdown or fallout from occurring. With the generators down, power was now being supplied by batteries with a life of no more than 8 hours each, the last resort the plant had in an emergency of this nature. Furthermore, inside reactor 1, even some of the batteries had failed. The reactor core was not being cooled sufficiently, and both temperature and pressure inside the containment building were rising. Eventually, a day after the tsunami, there was an explosion in the reactor building and the roof collapsed. Engineers made a desperate attempt to cool the reactor core by pumping salt water into it, but the damage had already been done and the reactor had begun leaking. It was confirmed later that same day that meltdown had occurred. That is the end of section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers.